Book One, Ireland. Chapter One, Ancestors. I remember olive green pea soup wool leggings, wearing them when it was wet and cold, pulling them on over my red rubber boots that smelled like the hold in the bowels of an old boat. To this day, I hate pea soup. I hate lima beans and celery as much as those pants, and somehow they contributed to me hating the rain, the wet, cold fog of a New England day. I wanted snow, something that would make this fuss of a costume worth it. Yet such rarely came to the shores of New England, not so terribly different than the shores of Ireland, from whence we came so very long ago. I remember reading the Bible stories to my one-year-old brother at age six, stepping into the call to bring mystery, God's spirit, into everyday life. Not that he or so many have paid such intense attention as I had wanted then or ever since. Yet I still read on. I had to find that bigger story than the one at my kitchen table from early in life. I remember one special weekend, planting cherry trees in a bare field just purchased by my dad, who left the house each day at 6 a.m., only to return after dark. We were summoned at 7, just when the evening news ended, and invited to bring his slippers, sit on his lap, and find his hidden tie clip. These were some of the few intimate moments I cherish, like needles in the haystack of childhood. It was only after 16, with a driver's license, when I offered to drive him to the train station each day, that I remember a conversation we actually had. Usually, a political discourse about the state of our world. With my mom, the memories at a young age are even harder to track. Scattered images of her working behind a large mahogany desk each day, managing, I was told, the affairs of our life. One morning, I do recall I was feigning illness yet again, quite a pattern of mine to avoid that journey to school. She knelt down beside me, and for the first and perhaps the only time I remembered, sincerely asked what was wrong. What was I afraid of, and why I was so sad? I didn't really have answers, and perhaps even fell more silent, hoping to secure her attention for a bit longer. And it was then that I saw her. A tear on her face as she told me how sad she had been when her father died. She had been 14. And I remember having many grandfathers, although not that one, who was an inventor, an explorer, a wild man it looked at heart from the photos that we were given. After he invented the electric shaver, our family story of privilege seemed to take off. Nana was a matriarch who took the reins of his creation as well as of our family. She ran the Schick Company, outlived three husbands, and even more sadly, laid to rest her three daughters before passing herself at 93. She owned the Shamrock Isle Hotel in Miami Beach, an old folks' home not far away, and she made Santa Claus come to life every Christmas for a family she dreamed. Even though I truly remember the laughter, the good food, spirit, and many gifts, the fruits of this kind of success always raise questions within. Why were the Black people serving us, cooking our food, cleaning up afterwards, and so much more, loving us, holding us, driving us, dressing us, reading to us, feeding us most everything we needed. Where were their children, their families? Why did Billy, Tina's husband, visit us only on weekends? Where did he go at night? I slowly came to realize this was the way many people lived who had, quote, made it, who were white, privileged, who had somehow worked or inherited their way out of so-called poverty. This was the reward for my dad's working 12 hours a day, starting as a runner in an investment firm and rising through the ranks to be chair of the board. And this was my mom's destiny, to have worked during the war, running a canteen truck, danced with an army private, and married with a veil as long as the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York where she stood. How my dad worked to deserve the beauty, the class, the story my mom had become was in the headlines of the New York Post. Heiress marries private. The imprint to keep moving up and out was, it seemed, embedded in both family lineages. In the 50s, such movement meant out of New York, into the suburbs, into the Connecticut where the etiquette was clear. Mom, the housewife, three kids, weekends on the golf course, church on Sundays, and vacations once a year, and twice if lucky. Kids taken care of by others. Showing up for occasional parties, a supper out now and then, and a weekend romp in my Nana's pool. Best schools. Signed up to the convent boarding school at age 12. Actually signed up at birth. Although it was only 15 minutes from our home, I was to live there for 4 years. All of this for sure a far cry from hardship. Yet equally in hindsight, a strange display of privilege. The fruits of such success always raise questions with me early on. I spent much of my teens trying to understand and not totally reject or disrespect this upward mobile dream of progress. I listened to stories of the Depression, my mom's crib being a drawer in a chest. I sat with my Irish granny every other Sunday, a tough survivor bound to a chair in a tiny New York apartment, suffering with emphysema for the last years of her life. I visited my uncle, my parents' friends, and heard their views of admiration and loyalty, celebration of the life my parents had achieved. But actually, I spent much of my time with Tina, who spoke openly of her situation as a Black woman and took me into her family, who lived 20 minutes away, took me into her confidence and her views about it all. Her honesty and love were contagious and gave me the courage to ask more, to feel more, to challenge more this system of success that I was growing up in. It was not until my mom's death when I was 28 that some expression of gratitude, what today maybe might be called reparations, became a possibility. But that story must wait. Alongside a tinge of Irish and German memory, there was always an international, intercultural story present in my early years. Grundy was from England, the nanny of my baby brother. Oh my God. And not so long after, arrived two Dutch women to live with us and take charge of the kids. My dad, he was off to Hong Kong, Beirut, and many places I would continually search for on the map, while my mom bundled us up in woolies, again to return to her father's favorite land, Montebello, Canada. But more memorable than the land was the life and home I found early on in the water. My first love lived a lot of his days on a boat and crossed the Atlantic more than once. I longed for such a journey, as weekend sails were never enough for me. My convent school was on a peninsula surrounded by water, and we lived in a small cabin built on piers in my senior year. This was closer to heaven than the kneeling in the bare wooden pews each morning at 6 a.m. The New Year's in Canada took place on the St. Lawrence River, homeland of the great white beluga whale. And spring breaks always took me to the south, to Miami Beach on the water with Granny, and further into the islands every weekend. For she was a fisherwoman, and in between cocktails actually had many a trophy to show for it. For me, the boat, the island, the water soon became the only places that I wanted to be. It's hard to turn fully into the sadness within and surrounding much of life within this earth world, where and what we have come to as humans within it. Mostly my parents wanted to hear everything is fine, as most parents do. It's harder to face the madness of it all. Who wants to hear that? I thought I was strong enough, whole enough, maybe even holy enough, to return again to Germany and to Ireland, to some part of my ancestors' journey, to ask again how and if I am part of their dream truly. If they are with me in a good way, or are they with me in some other way? Simply continuing to pull me down, hold me back, or laugh at my longing. So many cultures I know and respect emphasize their relationship with their ancestors. Always in their prayers, always at their backs, so humble they are in the face of those who have come before. And yet, as I open my mind, my heart, my prayer to the past, it is so often the wars that come in, so many struggles, one after another, like waves on a beach. The harm caused and received, the suffering. I find myself still wanting distance, often, more than closeness. Change more than continuity, release more than connection. In my 20s, my college years, I could only go home, back to the home of my parents, for 4 days max before I became ill. I would prepare myself mentally, physically, emotionally. Once there, I would run, walk, pray, play in the sunlight as much as I could find the time, in between suppers filled with alcohol, mostly talk of the weather, or at best the news, which on US TV was rarely good. I would make the journey east once a year out of love, respect, loyalty, obligation, and cultural expectation for sure. And even once a year required attention, discipline, and practice. I would embark upon the plain like a holy quest, seeking peace. In those days, I would search for something, anything within each member of my family that I could relate to, that in some way was a clue, if not an answer, to my longing for truth and love. My parents were divorced by that time, and each attempting to begin life again with a new partner. My dad's heart and career had been broken altogether. In 1 year, he lost his company, his job, his money, his brother to suicide, his wife, his family, the home we had built. The one memory where there was some feeling of something we had done together. I remember driving by that little cherry tree orchard we planted when I was maybe 7, trying to get a glimpse of them past the boundary of new owners. 5 acres, once bare, then developed with a big house, dreams and trees, now in the hands and hearts of strangers. It all seems strange, for sure. Home in all of its manifestations, simply gone. My dad, that first year after the divorce, was living in a hotel room in New York, smoking one cigarette after another. I remember the smell like yesterday, mixed with scotch every night at 5. It was a pattern that seemed to keep him alive, but not one I could look to for any solace. I listened to his loss. I loved him through it and mourned the passing of romantic love that his relationship with my mother had embodied. She was now remarried, only 6 months later, which did not look good to the church or to the kids. Who was this man? The new house we were invited to call home. And what was he doing every day in it? Tracking our calls, cooking for Mom, watching Hogan's Heroes on TV, and sipping on water from morning until night. Water. Water that we soon realized was vodka, what quickly became the poison and the shadow of a new life and love. It was my aunt that caught my eye, my attention during these years, for she had disappeared from the Christmas ceremony that had been really the only time we saw who our expanded family relations were. And now there were a diminishing number of seats at the big table. Aunt B, we heard, had gone to Vegas, and I had to find out where and why. She was the first I knew to have left New England, and this calling had been growing in me for years. I remember watching Westerns on TV all the time I could negotiate. Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers, Gunsmoke, and at long last discovering Annie Oakley. Any female heroines were far and few between. I remember asking if those places, those canyons, those sandy washes where all were riding, did they really exist? And if so, my God, why were we living here? It seemed they gave me after the ocean, the stream a few blocks away from home, the next experience I had of true beauty. I fell in love with the places, even more than those best-looking cowboys. The day after college graduation, I borrowed my mom's old white Buick and drove west. I barely stopped along the way. I had dreamed it would be to California, as far as the next ocean. But Colorado grabbed me first as the place to land. And still, I had to see my Aunt B in Las Vegas and find out more, why she left, what moved her and called her to such a different life. Aunt B was living in the largest RV I had ever seen in my life. And we had grown up with some classist notion that any and all who lived in trailers, as my family named them, were white trash, the trailers and the people. I had to make a quick reframe to see the beauty of her chosen life in an RV with a man twice her age. Rather than this home be a signature a reflection of any poverty, I soon learned that he was amongst the wealthiest of people on the Strip and owned not one, but a few of the casino hotels. For 3 days, I became Cinderella, as my aunt offered to buy me any dress I wanted, a necessity as I only owned hiking boots and blue jeans. We watched Muhammad Ali fight Jerry Quarry in the first row. We gambled in the back rooms amongst the stars and closed the last night off with singing "Ain't No Mountain High Enough," Diana Ross. I remember walking out to the parking lot the next day, 110 degrees, finding items on my dashboard melted. Where were the mountains, the water, the life that I was seeking in this Disney-made world, Vegas? I had found the desert, but it did not look anything like the ones on TV, at least yet. I had found my aunt, and I loved her leaving, more actually than what she had found. After a master's degree in economics at 50, a life in the fast lane of Vegas and many spas in between, her new story did not take a good turn. I only remember hearing that after my mom died of breast cancer, that she had her breasts removed. One of the early experiments, they say, in cancer prevention. And a year later, she died of leukemia. Not finding the strands of happiness I had hoped, my search continued. There was something still calling me west. And at the same time, I returned once a year to the old story, asking for my roots to reveal something worth watering. I woke this morning in Ireland, remembering Heidi, our first St. Bernard, and then Wanda, and then Lady. What beauties they each were, with totally different personalities, always best revealed when it snowed. It snowed more back then, 3 feet at a time 1 year, allowing us to build huge forts in between the tall hedges around our house. Battle was still in our blood. If I wasn't watching endless World War II movies, I was creating fields of defense wherever I was. At all girls' schools, all the way through college, there was plenty of room to compete and excel. And being top of any game was my passion. Adventures called, and Heidi, tied to a sled, seemed a stellar idea. Only resulting in one of many crashes and injuries, leaving my sister with a broken arm and me with yet an unfulfilled fantasy. Pretending to gallop through the field as horses was a bit safer, along with role-playing P.T. and Chuck, two helicopter pilots from TV. I wanted to take off, to fly, to have somehow, anyway, go anywhere and get far beyond those picket fences of Connecticut. Driving on the parkways, one could never see beyond the trees lining the road. And even as a young passenger, straining to look up, I could rarely tell what kind of day it was, other than gray. I felt claustrophobic, extreme in my body, in my moods, in my energy, and my desire for more. My sister married right away, as they would say, choosing a life. I watched closely as the next in line. She, who had loved her horse more, it seemed, than any human, now gave her attention to him. And so I prayed for her, for us, actually. I truly did, that the romance we had been raised to believe in, even if it failed for our parents, still could be possible. Her earlier fiancé had been my choice till then, and yet he was Jewish, and his family rejected a marriage with Catholics. This was a heartbreaking wake-up to another place and way in the world that seemed unjust at best. And yet I knew so little. Who was to say that arranged marriages did not have merit after all the divorces I had witnessed? So now this big, loud, some thought handsome, red Corvette driver was going to take my sister to a new home and life. They live today 15 minutes away from where we all began. She raises hunting dogs. He hunts. They have downsized from an enormous stone mansion that they first lived in. That fairy tale ended with the bank taking over the mortgage. And they seem happy enough by Connecticut standards, I guess. Yet there is nothing there then or now I could or can find that informs the longing, the soul, the dream of more that I move with. It's hard to rationalize the care of pets, dogs, much less the breeding of them when, yes, I have to say it, children are hungry, not only in the so-called third world, but throughout the U.S. I wonder how to sleep well with that fact. The dollars that I know spent on vets, costumes, dog, cat, and bird food, birds in cages, waking everyone in my sister's house at dawn. I see the love that they elicit, the love that they receive and give, and the companionship they provide to some, and feel, well, not so much judgment, actually, as a bit of confusion. So much of the picture seems missing. So curious how a lens is small enough to keep the realities of others at such a distance, or how some annual check to a charity can cover it all. I'm so struck how one person's fulfillment and destiny can be so different from another's, coming out of the same womb. I love my sister, and know she loves and is loved by many. I would be there for her in any way I could if she called. Blood is deep, if not thick. But she will not call me. Only on Christmas and Thanksgiving, as we were taught to do. For more is not wanted. No wider pictures or lens would serve to sustain all that she has created. And so I move on. On the subject of ancestors, I would be remiss not to spend more time speaking of Nana, the one who discovered cancer at the same time as my mother. She, however, lived through and beyond it, while none of her daughters were able. When I look at the only photo I have of her parents standing in a Vermont field, they look to be the hardiest folk farmers one has ever seen. I felt pride a bit in discovering them after Nana had passed on. No one was much into sharing the family stories, but pictures speak a lot. Somehow seeing them in Vermont was in part a confirmation of my shared lineage and connection with that land. My parents shipped me off to camp there for 7 summers, and this was one of the true highlights of my childhood. It was there that I learned more of my home in the natural world, my love of being on or in the water. My fantasies of riding in the wind bareback came true as a kind of communion feeling with all of life. Community life was at the core of each 2-month stint, and this sense of belonging was balm for my longing. Where we lived in Connecticut, I had to be driven to find a playmate, and that need alone left me dependent on adults in an unacceptable way. Having to plan, arrange, pick which friend, when, and for how long seemed at best unnatural. And so it was the non-human world that filled the void. Shagbark Lane with its brook just down the road or a small corner of woods behind our earliest family home. There I would make my place, collecting discarded trash to some, but sacred store goods for me. Old fallen trees marked the land where I could engage in conversation, in circle, in company, with all I had found and all who found me there. I remember kindergarten actually being the first council of sorts with humans. We were invited to bring some object special to us and share its story, show and tell, and all would listen, actually listen, and hold the peace, a talking peace. I would bring something from the woods, my place, the enchanted forest, as it appeared to me, and share a bit of what mattered most. Years later, I returned to those woods, that brook which had seemed a river, as well as that camp in Vermont. I actually rode my bicycle all through Vermont until I reached that camp, as I had Ireland in my early 20s. Attempting to reclaim what truly mattered. Most every time, younger and older, I found myself again called to the water. Even that lake in Vermont had a flow, a movement, a freedom I perceived, offering an experience beyond boundaries. All were places to mirror perhaps the womb I had left and the one I was trying to find. Now walking on this water planet called Earth. There is that old saying, home is where the heart is. Yet this never quite made sense to me as helping to identify place. For my heart moves. It traveled each day with each story, each person, each place. It could open wide when in the Wild West, and it could stay close to home when next to anyone that showed up on my doorstep. From the earliest of years, my heart traveled with news to remote lands, and I found new relatives there, as well as amongst those in service. For sure, there were those paid to love us, but anyone awake, I do believe, could feel the difference between that and real connection. With Tina, who I mentioned early on, our time together right up to her death was more real, honest, open, and true than most any other adult had offered. Long after she left our home, and I had as well, we would meet, we would write, we would talk together when I came to town. She would help me to understand some of those family dynamics and even share some of the so-called family secrets that her loyal service had made room to reveal. What had happened between my parents? What had happened to the money? What had happened with me being who I was and the way I was in the middle? And I would learn more about what happened for her. Her family in the post-slavery life. After my mother died, and there was an unexpected amount of money available, it did not take long to know I wanted to share it with Tina. No sum could ever be reparations for the years spent away from her own family. No sum could replace the system we and she were determined by. And my inquiry into why it was the way it had been and still continued throughout the world, never ceased. And yet some guidance led me to water the best stories I could find where I was. The bigger story of slavery and oppression and our role within it all naturally led me to the ancestor history. The wars, the property consciousness and reality, the fight over and fight for more. More control, more comfort, more safety, more power, more land, more freedom, Was that my longing as well? I asked over and over again. What came was to make the heart home wherever I was, with whoever I was with, to make relations the best they could be, no matter what the law, the culture, the family, or the system. And so I asked Tina her dream, now in her late 60s, now taking care of another family's home and their belongings. And she shared it. She shared it with clarity, like she had been waiting all of her life to be asked to move back to Virginia, to be able to buy the land her father had briefly owned as a freed slave, and to build her home there. This claiming of home felt real, felt important, felt something I actually did not know, feel, or have, but something that I could offer and give. I contacted my brother and sister and asked them to chip in, and we bought the land, found with Tina, the builder, and restored something, maybe a small part of such a story, yet a significant something. I was sailing a boat from the Bahama Islands to Miami for its owner, a delivery job, when I stopped in Nassau to check my messages. In those days, of course, there were voice messages on answering machines, and I heard my sister's, "Come immediately. Nana is in the hospital, and doctors say she has 36 hours to live at the most. Her lungs are filling with water. We are all here. Where are you?" I was on the next plane to New York and arrived to find others gathered in my Nana's hospital room. My brother, my aunt, my sister, two cousins, some for sure I only saw at Christmas. It was October, the same month my mom had died, and I could not help but swim in that water of memory yet again. Mom had been dying in the hospital when they called me home from Greece. I spent 11 days at her bedside drawing a big rainforest filled with flowers, coloring in the birds, the trees that I had grown to love in their fine details. I had found this coloring book poster in the airport, looking for some way to be each day with my mom, as I wanted her to be comfortable. I knew she would not be up for long silences, not to mention anything like meditation. Simply being present, not so focused on her or a needed conversation, made most sense. She never had liked my many questions, and the last time I had attempted to tell her why I was living with a man rather than simply getting married, she simply raised her hand and said, "I don't want to know." At least she was honest, and not so dissimilar, ironically, from my dad in my numerous attempts at what seemed real, if not meaningful, conversations. He had reached over the lunch table, now at a time that included cocktails as well, and said, "Geej, I like to keep it superficial." People have laughed when I share this story, and yet I have always come a bit to the defense of my dad. It was truly an honest moment. Neither of them, my parents, seemed to have the capacity to revisit the heart matters too much or too often. Theirs had been broken, perhaps too much, for too long, and they had no advice, no true repair on some level, even within their second marriages. And so my mom and I sat together for many hours each day as doctors came and went and even dared to suggest one more surgery. The cancer was now growing visibly out of my mom's chest, an open wound so shocking that even my long walk on pilgrimage time in Greece could not have prepared me for. I was surprised that she showed it to me, this vulnerable, oozing, large, open sore was somehow the bearing of her heart. That last morning, I told her my boyfriend, who I had just broken with after 7 years, had called. He was at his old home at his parents', just 20 minutes down the road. He was hurting. He was lost. He had stopped taking his medication. Before I had known him, he had tried to kill himself, and now he seemed headed in that direction again. My mom listened. She wanted to know. She dared, she engaged, she advised. Something I had longed for. She said, "Go to him, Gigi." I remember her voice, her saying my name, which she so rarely did. "I'll be okay," she said. "I'll be here. You can come back tonight." So I went. He and I met and walked in the woods together behind my Nana's house, and I listened. I did not advise. I could not rescue even if I wanted to. I could only remind him of how nature was our home, our healer. Earth ways had been our way. I encouraged him to remember and find the healing that was there for him. The darkness did not leave the woods nor his eyes. He was already with another woman, and it did not matter. I would always love him and showed him what I could. By the time I returned to the hospital, maybe 8 p.m., I arrived to find my mom in a coma. I sat down and continued to fill in the rainforest colors. I was calm with her, somehow relieved the doctors would not now operate again. This could not be fixed, nor so many things in life as we know. At midnight, I finished the large poster painting. It had taken me 11 days, and I had started the day I arrived. 5 minutes later, my mom passed. Somehow the connection was confirmed through that timing. Don't remember crying that night. I only remember those moments with her and somehow a bigger story connection with a bigger timing, a bigger mystery. The God, the spirit of it all was confirmed. She knew when I should leave. And I knew with her where and how to be. The peace I touched then at her death, with the dead, with perhaps my ancestors, was further awakened. Such feelings return again throughout my life. Special moments, I call them. This is a true privilege, if there is any. And for this, I am truly grateful. I don't remember crying even much over the next few days, only at the wake. It went on for hours. Brent, my ex, had promised to come, but one more promise was to be broken. I knew I could not rest my head or heart in his hands, but somehow in such a tender moment, I forgot. He, showing up, even with his desire to be there for me, was just not possible. 5 days later, he returned to Colorado and cut his wrists in the condo in the home we had shared. It was clear I too could not be there for him in his cry for help. Others came. And I came a week later to do what I could with what had been left behind. His blood family took charge, and he physically recovered and made a life again. He went back to Connecticut roots and created what only seems to be a beautiful family. I met and loved them easily years later, when Brent finally passed over, naturally, some might say, with Lou Gehrig's disease. What he chose to reclaim in Connecticut was clearly not a path for me. And I mention him now to honor the place our lives met and how we learned to live together with the other, man, woman. Though we were seen to be a similar culture or class, even at times a match made in heaven, the world we shared deep love of, our destinies, our soul's longing, perhaps a way to name such, they were radically different. He wanted to give me the biggest diamond ring I had ever seen to wear, to show, to signify I was his. And that was a clear no for me. The ring I was soon to own came from Nana, who, by the way, I have not forgotten, who I left pages back lying in a hospital bed. Forgive me these seeming tributary stories, but they just come with the river. To name Bryn at this part of the story seems no mistake, as it was with him that I bicycled for a month around Ireland, as well as a month across New England. For me, these journeys confirmed a connection and an honoring of my roots, along with the calling to keep moving west, to give attention to the water and to the farthest shores of the island I was now on. For Brent, he had called me to Colorado, and together we had, for a significant time then, stepped out of the New England heritage. For him, he found he needed to go back. And for me, with my mom's death, I knew I had to go on, go further than I had dared to go to now, both inside and out. It's many times I have returned to the pain and the spirit experienced in my mom's early passage. 54, so young she was, to never know her as the wise and beautiful woman I suspect she would have become. And though she never said it in so many words, it was the class, the culture, the married life, the becoming of a Connecticut suburban wife that was her destiny. And in some ways, I dare say I feel her doom. I never felt she loved much of it. The club, the kids even, the trips, the social life. And she certainly never guided me towards any of it. Her dissatisfaction with her privilege was in part a seed for my search beyond the script I was being offered. At a time when the alternative pictures were pretty limited, somehow it was her and my grandmother's spirit that kept me going. And it had to be Nana's spirit that kept her going. Beyond the loss of all three daughters and four husbands, beyond the prognosis of the best doctors. Shortly after I arrived that evening, Nana sat up in bed. We all gathered around, a bit like the scene from The Godfather, waiting for last instructions from Don Corleone. She smiled. She actually beamed. So happy it seemed to have her dream come true at last. The whole family, despite all the bumps, sickness, divorces, and upsets, all at least minus a few of those husbands, were there together. And it wasn't even Christmas. The next day, the day she was supposed to die, she sat up again in bed. We all decided to give her and each other gifts like it was Christmas. I set the game to pick one name from a hat and find the right gift. Only it could not be bought. What a sharing that was of hand-me-downs and non-material treasures that we exchanged. A few days later, Nana came home and lived for some weeks longer, dying just before Christmas in her own home, in her own bed, amongst the many dreams that she had fulfilled. So what did my ancestors learn over millenniums? What do I need to remember, to learn, to know, so that I am not dependent on now and the future. What umbilical cord, as Chumash Elder Semu would say, perhaps needs to be cut? What, I would ask, of the old story needs to be brought forward into the new? And what true dramatic shift in culture, in our awareness of ancestors, might change the world of injustice, the direction of climate change so clearly predicted? Everything I did in the women's movement, the civil rights, the anti-war movement, still brought me to the same precipice. How would we be radically different when in power, when in the hierarchy of responsibility? Same questions arose at the end of every demonstration, whether against the wars in America, Vietnam, Iraq, Israel, Syria. What were we offering different? What were we saying yes to, daring to dream or suggest, or most of all, to manifest? As I continued to feel and feed my ancestors, to pray for their help, I kept returning to the don't know mind on a daily basis, living from there, only able to see a short way ahead. I returned to the basics time and time again. Breath and water. I am living on stolen land, unceded territory. I am deeply aware of the history of genocide on Turtle Island and how I am complicit most anywhere I land. When exactly my ancestors came over and where they actually landed or how they behaved is a mystery. Maybe they were amongst the worst, and maybe they were amongst the most gracious, humble, and worthy of guests. Regardless, the disaster ensued, and so the old saying goes, if I am not part of the solution, I continue as part of the first problem. Class one error, they call it in permaculture. Something is off from the start, and everything from there goes south, and will at best be a band-aid on a lifelong wound. The wound, the trauma of colonization and domination in this land and throughout the world continues. It's not just past history. It is within the root cause of the anger at best, along with chronic illness and suicide of indigenous peoples. It also affects all of us, whether a denied awareness below current greed or an obsessive need for security, repressed guilt, shame, or just low, simmering sorrow. American presidents continue to cry, whether Democrat or Republican, Obama or Trump, that we are the greatest nation. This strikes me as a bizarre, egocentric overclaim, covering of our flaws and our history like an insecure kid in a sandbox standing up. Naming truth, naming wrongdoing, owning our past building of our great nation on slave labor, on warfare against the original peoples would be a step to recovery. Then there is the setup of extraction industries and practices worldwide, too often cloaked in trade agreements and support of democracy. I think it was the late 70s when the laws preventing freedom of religion for Native Americans were finally changed. The one freedom that my ancestors fought for, we took from them. The wounds get passed on. Patterns of passing the injustice, the abuse, the wound are not unique by any means. They exist throughout our lands and nations, Israel, Palestine. They exist within our own communities and families, sexual abuse to violent wars. What I have learned after years of listening, of research, is that individual therapy may help, but that the systemic change needed will take a different kind of time and attention. As we sit in circles and listen, as we create ceremonies to initiate our youth and break the loops of negativity, we can build healthy communities to be healthy cells, even in an ill body. We can listen for where and how to be part of the healing. We can make reparations to share, if not return, lands, to support the legal and financial battles against injustice. We can own our history as settlers, reconsider ourselves as guests, reconsider what our privilege has granted. We can listen for where to be and what is ours to do, to learn, to share, to offer, and be willing to change, and yes, to sacrifice, to make sacred.